When in doubt, plug it in. All right. Okay, so let's go ahead and get started. Just a reminder that a week from a few hours ago, you'll have exam two. And I may have arranged a room, or I may have forgotten to. Either way, I've emailed Janet and hope to either get a reminder of the room I've arranged or get a room, and I'll email you and let you know where it is. I have requested that we have a room for around 4:30 to 6 on Monday where I'll be available to answer basic questions concerning the exam. So I call it the Q&A session, not so much a review session because I'm not going to drive it, but I'll respond to your questions. In terms of the material, it'll be from where the material left off for exam one up to the start of AC circuits. So we will go through LC oscillations, which actually is a we sort of discussed as a DC thing, or at least we hadn't mentioned the word alternating current yet. So we haven't put in an alternating EMF at that point. So the problems and lecture stuff up to that. So through workshop 9, which is this week, through problem 6 on problem set 9, there are a few simple AC problems on the problem set for this week, but not much. So I'm not trying to get you going too far into that. And through sort of the end of November 2nd lecture. So any questions on this? The drill will be the same. 3-inch by 5-inch index card, anything you want on either side, not topologically enhanced sort of thing. Calculator, something to write with. Yes? It is my intent, it is my fervent desire to have a formula sheet. There will be a formula sheet on the exam. It is my fervent desire to have that formula sheet produced ahead of time and posted on the web. I happen to know that I've got sort of some personal things that are going to make this week and the weekend a bit busy, so I'm not exactly sure when I'll have that ready, but I'll try to get it as soon as I can. Yes?
It seems like it's jumping in. For the final, are we going to be using our two previous index cards, or is it still going to be one index?
For the final, I'll either let you have an 8.5 by 11-inch sheet of paper, or if you would rather use your two index cards and we add a third index card or something like that, I'm happy either way with that. Yes?
Is there like RLC impedance on this thing?
Not impedance. That's an AC thing. Yeah, so nothing I'll talk about today, even the review piece of today isn't going to be on the exam, right? So the review piece of Thursday's lecture may have had a little bit of stuff on LC oscillations, but that was actually covered the lecture before. So, anything else? And to the extent that LC oscillations sort of bleed into the AC world, I mean, I'll have to stay away from that. If I were to ask you anything about LC, it would be in the spirit of what we had done up to that point. All right. So, a reminder of where we were last time. Actually, we had an alternating current EMF, and we had investigated what an alternating current EMF does across each of the individual circuit elements in terms of generating a current. And if we look at the blue here and consider that to be the phase of the EMF, in fact, let's say that's the EMF, and then the other colors are the current across each of the elements. If the EMF has this sort of time structure, then the current across the resistor has that same structure. The relative amplitude depends on the size of the resistance, and the relative amplitudes don't take seriously here because it depends on your choices for the various elements. But what you find is that the current across the inductor is out of phase and looks like this, and the current across the capacitor is out of phase and looks like that. So if we look at the EMF across each of these elements and the voltage drop across each of them, then you come up with something like this, okay, where this is basically the same form as the EMF. So we have this as a sine omega t plus phi. This one will be a sine omega t plus phi. And these will be out of phase accordingly based on the analysis we did earlier. So then the question is, what does the current look like? And we know that with everything that we've seen, the current will take some basic form. So it'll be some sort of harmonic function, and it'll have some sort of maximal value. And you really don't know what the phase will be relative to the EMF. And the EMF is going to go as sine omega t here. So you really don't know what this magnitude is or that phase angle relative to this EMF and the phase of the EMF. So you have to do some analysis, which I'm not going to drag you through. Your book does it, I think, in a graphical way. If you look up the previous incarnation of Ohanian, it certainly does it with trigonometric functions as well as a graphical way. But when you play with this, and if you take an ECE course, you may have to get dragged through this mud. But I am more interested in the result than the trigonometric stuff that gets you to this. But what you find when you look at this equation is that the tangent of this phase angle, okay, it goes as the inductive reactance minus the capacitive reactance over the resistance. And since these all have sort of units of ohms, this is a unitless number, which is what you want if you have a tangent phi for a phase angle. And you find that the maximum current is equal to this Emax over this quantity, which we call the impedance. We define it as the impedance. It's a combination of the resistance and the capacitive and inductive reactances, which are, remind you, when we looked at the current going through the individual, through an alternating current EMF across each of the individual types of elements, like an inductor or capacitor separately, what we found was there was a quantity that acted as if it were a resistance. In other words, it was the piece that came in inversely proportional to the current. And so for the inductor, that's the inductive reactance. For the capacitor, it's the capacitive reactance. And this quantity is now known as the impedance in this particular circuit. And it turns out that if we put in what we mean by the capacitive and inductive reactances, then we get this quantity, omega L and 1 over omega C. So this would be the inductive reactance, this would be the capacitive reactance. And if we now approach the natural frequency of this circuit, if you were to think of it in terms of an LC circuit, that is this natural frequency of 1 over the square root of LC, then this term approaches zero. And when that happens, this impedance becomes as small as it can be because the resistance is an unchanging thing. And that means you're going to get a peak in the current. There may be different ways of looking at this. I have a demo where I unfortunately, haven't spent the time with Tang, and he set up the demo to sort of look at a different aspect of this, and it wasn't trivial to figure out how to make it show the current spike. So I'll try to find time to sit with Tang and figure that one out for next lecture. At any rate, if you take the omega and you change it, scan it across, as you get approach this omega zero, which corresponds to this 1 over the square root of LC, you'll find that the current will spike. Okay, so at a very particular frequency where you're hitting this thing, you'll get this resonant oscillation, resonant current. So you can think of this as very similar to all sorts of mechanical resonances, like swing sets or destructive resonances of wind going across a bridge, or anything like that, sort of forced oscillations. So, any questions on this? So this kind of thing, of course, you can now imagine you can use for all sorts of tuning things, right? You now basically can adjust something, and you'll get a current spike when you get it adjusted just right in terms of frequency. So this is a basis for tuning mechanisms in electrical instruments. All right. We could do a lot more with AC circuits. I'm not going to do that. If you want to learn more about them, work in a lab or do electrical engineering or whatever, and you'll learn a lot more. But I did want to give you a taste of them. What I'd like to look at next would be magnetic fields in matter. So you can imagine that we have a coordinate system, Cartesian system, and let's have the y go up, so x off to the side, and the z coming out at you. And if we have a current loop, so you can imagine having some sort of loop . So I'm trying to draw something where the short side is bisected by the z-axis, and the thing is free to rotate around the z-axis in principle. And there's some it is cocked at some angle in the xy plane a little bit. So that's the basic idea. So let's say there's an angle theta. Oops. So there's an angle theta. Is this thing actually on? Hello? I guess not. All right, let me see if I can get the battery replaced. So let's imagine that we have a magnetic field that's pointed up in the y direction, and we have a current loop so that the current is going around like that and around the loop. This loop, the current loop, will have a magnetic moment which is hard to draw in 3D, but I'm basically trying to draw something that is coming out normal to this, to the plane of this loop. I got bored studying when I was at your stage. we would put a trash can in the corner of a room and then get the erasers and set them up like this and then kick them into the trash can. And, you know, it is absurdly hard and a ridiculous thing to do, spending your time. No alcohol involved. This was just avoiding studying. And the sad thing was, this one guy that I would study with and we would do this, we got really good at it. I mean, if there were an international competition, we'd have been world champs. I mean, there's no question about it. We got to where we could put top spin on the thing. And oh, there's a twist, too. The trash can would be right there, and there was like a doorway here, and you had to like have your hand here, but you could try to defend the trash can if you were not the person kicking. So we had this great game all set up. And I was amazing at it. I was really good. Just so you know, I mean, you knew me way back when you find it on Wikipedia, eraser kicking into trash can fame, the Hall of Fame induction. Okay, so if we now have the z-axis coming straight into our eyeball, then we have a current coming out at us here and going into the board there, and then the side of the current loop goes like so. So let's think a moment about what's going on here. We have the magnetic field going straight up. So if we look at this piece of current, right, it's basically in the XY plane, and it's going down at some angle. Okay, it's not in the plane. It's off in Z a little bit, but it's parallel to the plane. So if we look at IDL cross B, here's IDL is going this way, crossing the B. There's going to be a force outward in Z. So there's a force here that is coming out. You all right with that? And if we look at what's going on over here, if the z-axis is coming out at you, this wire is going like so. The current is going like this. So IDL cross B gives me a force back in Z. It's the same current, and although the drawing isn't perfect, it's supposed to be rectangular, so these two will cancel out perfectly and will not cause this loop to do anything. It's just trying to pull the loop apart, basically. It's what that force and that force will do. Look at this piece. We have, if this is the z-axis, this piece is now parallel to the z-axis. It's I. DL cross B is going to be a force, IDL cross, which is going in the negative x direction. So this force is sort of going like that. And then as we come around to this other piece, which is in Z, IDL cross B is going to be a force out that way. So we have a force like so. Now these two pieces are going to cause a torque about the Z-axis, right? Because those two pieces of force we have, if I can get the orientation right, so Z is coming out at you. So this arm basically is meant to be the piece up on top, and here's the piece down below. And I have a force going this way on this one and that way on that one. So it's going to cause this loop to rotate like this. You okay with that? So there'll be a torque on the loop. So the force up above is like this. The force down below is like that. And it's going to cause this thing to rotate like this. So mu is equal to the magnitude of mu is equal to the I times the A, I believe, right? And so the torque turns out to be mu cross b when you work it out. So I don't want to get too hung up on that, but I wanted to motivate the fact that if you have a little current loop in a magnetic field, there is a non-zero, there's a torque on it, which will cause it to align the magnetic moment with the magnetic field. Yeah?
That's not like a simple harmonic motion thing, though, right? Does it dampen or does it stay the same?
Yeah, it might be simple harmonic motion thing because while you have the torque on it, you have an I alpha, so you're accelerating the thing. I mean, if we look at it classically, you're accelerating the loop. So when it reaches the top, it's going to go past and then decelerate. So you might have, classically, you would have to have a damping mechanism to get it to stop. Otherwise, you'll have, I mean, if we put this around a completely classical axis and we started with a small angle, you could probably show it has simple harmonic motion. And now, having said that, what we're about to lead into is not classical. And when you get into the quantum mechanical world, you'll have non-zero, you'll have torques, but things don't react classically, so it's sort of not quite fair to think of it that way. So the reason that I'm bringing this up is that we think of materials very often as being made up of little current loops. And of course, any little current loop has a magnetic field, which has a dipole form of its own. And that's what we define as the magnetic moment as I times A for that loop, as I mentioned a moment ago. So that's where the cross-sectional area of the loop. So in matter, you can, there are different types of matter with respect to this. So let me just go ahead and jump into this. So we want to look at magnetism in materials. We have to consider what kind of material it is. So if you recall when we were looking at electric fields in materials, we had materials that had an inherent natural dipole moment or a separation of the positive and negative charge just by virtue of the chemical structure itself. So water, for example, where you have oxygen with two hydrogens and you tend to have more positive charge around the hydrogens, more negative charge around the oxygen. So there's a permanent little electric dipole moment for water. Carbon tetrachloride is a completely symmetrical thing. You've got the carbon in the middle and the four chlorines in sort of the four pinnacles of a tetrahedron. And so although you might have some separation of charge between the carbon and each chlorine, it's completely symmetrical, so the whole thing has no net electric moment. The same sort of thing happens with magnetism. Some molecules or atoms have what acts like an inherent little current loop, and some don't. And there is a correlation between what this current loop, how much of a current loop, or what we call it a magnetic dipole moment. Because if it has a little current loop, literally you can think of it classically as an electron spinning around in a circle, so it actually has a little magnetic field. Okay, so some atoms and molecules and nuclei will have inherent magnetic fields, but not all of them. Some don't. There is a correlation between the basic structure of the thing and whether you have it or not. So if you recall, which I hope you've seen, but if you recall how you, if you look at a multi-electron atom, how those electrons fill the atomic shell structure. There's a rule that when you can, you have them paired with one spin up and one spin down. When you've got that, a way to think of it is they'll sort of cancel each other out in terms of the inherent magnetic moment. But if you have unpaired electrons, then, for example, in iron, you have a number of unpaired electrons, and you can think of them as all pointing with the same orientation, and it will give a net magnetic moment to the iron atom. And so materials will vary with this, but we have to now worry about what happens with magnetism in materials depending on what, first of all, what the inherent properties of the material are to begin with. So let's start with something which is known as paramagnetic materials. So if you have a paramagnetic material, what you want to think of is that you have inherent magnetic dipoles in the material. Not super strong, in fact, not as strong as iron, but reasonable. I mean, you have some sort of little inherent dipoles. So let's imagine that we have a chunk of crud here, and within that crud, we will have some dipoles. So which I'm going to draw by little arrows. And you have to imagine that within this material, these dipoles will all exist, so they'll all have a little magnetic moment. But you also have thermal agitation, and depending on how the crystalline structure of the material is, these magnetic moments will be in random directions for the most part. There might be a little correlation between them, but it's not going to be a huge correlation in a paramagnetic material. So you want to imagine that these things are sort of in random directions. Okay, and now to this material, I want to add an external magnetic field. So now we have the same material, but I'm going to add an external magnetic field. And now what will happen is you have, for these inherent natural little dipoles, you'll have a non-zero torque. I mean, there's going to be a torque that will align them with the magnetic field. They will not align 100%. And you have thermal agitation and things that when they do line up, they sort of get knocked out of alignment. So there's going to be an equilibrium between how many of them are aligned and how many of them are not aligned. And that's going to vary from material to material. And it will vary depending on the strength of the field. So what I've done is I have now showed most of them have a pretty good down-to-up component in their magnetic moment, but they're not perfect, and they, you know, so they're going to be some variation, but it's not so much random. Okay, so that's one type of material. Then there's a material which we'll call diamagnetic. And in a diamagnetic material, there are no inherent dipoles. So if you have no magnetic field and you were to dig around, you're not going to find things that have an inherent dipole. Now what happens is if we add a magnetic field, an external magnetic field to this, something really strange happens. Besides the magnetic field disappearing, you get induced dipoles that oppose the magnetic field. Again, not perfectly, but for the most part, they'll begin to align. Now, I think maybe that doesn't strike you initially as so weird because we've just done induction and you're now pros at Lenz's law. So if you have a changing magnetic field, you expect to induce magnetic moments that are opposite to fight that change in the field. So if we have a field that is going from zero to some strength, you might sort of expect to see this a little bit. Classically, the minute this field reaches full strength, the induced magnetic moments go away. Right? And that doesn't happen quantum mechanically. So in a diamagnetic material, you actually get a field that is in the material, you get some induced field that opposes the external field, and it stays there. Okay? So it's pretty weird, and I'm not going to prove anything about that to you. I'm just going to, that's the way it is. It's not a classical effect. So, all right, so in this case, B in the material is increased. Right, if you have some external field, you now have these little magnetic moments. Think of them as little dipole magnets sitting in the material, and they orient with the magnetic field, which means the field in the actual field that you would measure if you were a fly flying through the material, which I guess makes no sense, but whatever. You would feel a magnetic field here which is stronger than the external field. It adds to it. Okay? Here, you would actually feel a weaker magnetic field. It is screened somewhat by this paramagnetic material. This is usually a smaller, harder to measure effect than this is. So you get less of this weakening than you say do the strengthening for your typical material. And then there's a third type of material which we'll call ferromagnetic. And primarily we mean iron, although there might be other ferromagnetic materials that are not used so commonly, not as commonly used. For a ferromagnetic material, you have very strong dipoles that are inherent in the material. So that's why iron is so important, because it's got these unpaired electrons that give it a very strong atomic magnetic dipole moment. Because these dipole moments are very strong, they interact with each other pretty strongly, which means there's local alignment. And then it's more than just that. You also have to have the crystalline structure be reasonable. So what will happen is you will get a fairly strong local alignment that gets frozen in place, basically, with the crystalline structure. And in time, these domains, we call them domains, they'll actually change in shape a little bit. And so things will move around, and you'll have domains in different directions for iron that has not experienced a strong magnetic field any time recently. So you have these sort of randomly shaped regions, and within each region you have fairly strong alignment, not perfect alignment, but fairly strong alignment. And the domains, of course, will fight each other a little bit, and as things get hot, they'll move around more. If they're cool, they'll move around less. So it's not really a liquid, but you do have these domains sort of changing around. So if we have this stuff and we put it in a magnetic field, now what will happen is it disappears. We have discovered, what is it they call it? The cloaking phenomenon. All right, so now what happens is you will have a torque on these things, and what it will mean is that the domains will begin to dominantly be aligned. Again, not perfectly, but you will begin to get alignment, and so within this whole process you'll have this torque and things will begin to align with the magnetic field. So depending on the crystalline structure of the iron and the strength of the field, you can get most of these things aligned. Sorry, trying to write too fast. So the external field aligns the domains. And so in this case, again, B is increased. But now you have fairly strong internal magnetic moments with each iron atom, and because of the crystalline structure sort of holding things a bit more in place, you tend to get a stronger enhancement of the B than you do with your typical paramagnetic stuff. You okay with this so far? Now, in all three cases, the degree of this alignment or this anti-alignment is going to depend on the strength of the magnetic field. And we're going to assume that it is linear, but that's an assumption that works for many materials, but in the real world, this alignment might not necessarily be perfectly along B. But we're going to assume that it's along or counter to B, and it's proportional to the strength. So we can have different types of materials in this world, and we're going to say that the magnetic field in the material is equal to mu zero times 1 plus chi m times B free. Okay, what is B free? B free is the external. So you might see it written as the XT, or you might see it written as free. All you really need is one constant here, but that makes it far too easy. So we need to be able to take this proportionality of the strength in the field in the material is proportional to the field external. We need to make this as complicated as possible. And remember, now you're learning a lot of physics, so career enhancement and job security are becoming paramount. So we have to hide this simple little relationship as much as we possibly can. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to, mu zero is already defined and one is already defined, so all we really need to do is make a table of this chi m, right, and that then quantifies this whole thing. So we can do that. So we can take this chi m right here, and we'll call this the magnetic susceptibility. Right? How susceptible is it to a magnetic field? So that makes some sense. And you can find a table for different materials of their magnetic susceptibility. All right? So that will work. But just for fun, what we're going to do is we're going to take this quantity and we're going to call that the relative permeability. All right. So again, information-wise, it's the same stuff, but your table is going to look totally different. Right? We basically now have this quantity, which we'll just call the relative permeability. And it's going to have a symbol which we will call K sub M. And then you'd like to be able to actually have it look simple and make some sense. So we're going to also have this thing. Which really is just mu zero times K sub m, and this is what we're going to call the permeability, and it's going to have a symbol mu. So are you ready to slit your wrists yet? This is truly ridiculous. There's no really different information in these, right? Yes?
Can chi m have negative values?
Yes. That's where we're headed next. In fact, it has to have, because we have to have this anti-alignment. Well, hold on a second. No, I'm sorry. Yes, it can have negative values, but it's going to be less than 1 because it will weaken your field, but it won't flip it inside the material. Yeah. So the relative permeability you can sort of think of as the magnetic analog to this the permittivity that we had when we had electric fields and materials where epsilon 0 sort of went to epsilon. Here, mu 0... in the case where you have no material, in the material goes to mu. And this is now going to be larger than or smaller than 1, but it will be positive because you don't flip the sign of the field, but you can weaken it or strengthen it. Okay? Chi m can be negative. So the tables of magnetic susceptibility, relative permeability, and permeability are all going to look different. But there's a one-to-one correlation. I mean, you should be able to use this relationship and go from one table to the other for the different materials. All right. I forget what your book actually uses, and I forget what I'm going to use on the test when we get there. But we'll use one of them. But I don't really. To me, they're just, it doesn't matter, right? And I don't care. I'll give it to you, or I'll ask you for a very particular one. Having said that, if it matters, you're doing an experiment and it actually matters, make sure you're looking at the right table and interpreting it the right way, or you have no idea what's going on, right? So just be, watch out for it. And don't blame it on me. All this was in place long before I came on the scene, so don't know why they have to do it this way. Okay. Now, so that was fun. It gets a little bit worse, but in a very practical sense. Iron is really great stuff because it has really strong magnetic moments in the iron atoms themselves. And as you begin to align these domains, you get a substantial increase in the magnetic field. And it comes for free, really. You can take this chunk of iron and you can put a current loop around it and put current through this loop, and it's not completely free because, you know, you use up energy to do that. You can align these things, all right? Now you can turn this current off. You can remove the loop. And you still have these things aligned because the crystalline structure or the domain structure sort of freezes them in place. They work on each other. So internal to this iron, you have a strong field which comes out externally. And that's why iron magnets are such great things. And they are so-called permanent magnets. Are they really permanent? No, because over time this will degrade. The domains will degrade a little bit, okay? And eventually the field will not be as strong. But you can imagine that in the laboratory, this is a phenomenal way to increase the bang for the buck in terms of the magnetic field you get for a certain current that you put through a loop. So it's very nice that way. And then you can create a nice permanent field, in a sense, in the lab. All you have to do is set it up, and then you've got this permanent magnet. If you want to ramp the field, though, which is what you end up doing in most kinds of spectroscopy or accelerator physics and things like this, then you have some issues because as you magnetize the iron, you're aligning more and more of these domains, but now you have all these domains aligned, and if you want to ramp it down, the current, for example, they stay aligned. And so that means as you ramp up the current, you get a stronger field, and then as you ramp down the current, that field stays where it was. So there's a lag there, and we call this hysteresis. So one thing I wanted to point out here, which is similar to what we had with the electric field, is this is just like we had a linear dielectric. When we talk about linear dielectrics, what we mean is that the electric field strength inside the material gets weakened in proportion, gets adjusted in proportion to the strength of the external field, which is basically what we have here as well. This, what's happening to the external field is changed in proportion what happens in the internal field relative to the external field gets changed in proportion to the strength of the external field. So it's a linear phenomenon, all right? But that's not so true in iron because iron has this lag. This is practically very important, okay? If you want to do anything with accelerators, if you want to do anything with spectroscopy in a laboratory, with nuclear magnetic resonance, for example, or electron spin resonance, anything where Zeeman spectroscopy, anything where you're splitting spectral lines, basically looking at spin flips in materials. So this is a really, really common thing to do in quantum mechanical, atomic, nuclear studies. You can take you can take a material, and when you put it in an external field, it will create an energy difference between the spin of the nuclei this way versus the spin of the nuclei that way. So you can then hit it with radiation that is exactly equal in energy to this difference. And when you hit it just right with that exact energy radiation, you'll get an absorption in that energy because the spins that are down this way will flip to that way. And that's what's known as nuclear magnetic resonance. And the reason this is so cool is that you know what your external field is, but the field that determines the exact energy where this flips happens to be dependent on the internal field that this thing feels, which depends on exactly the nuclei and everything that are around it, or maybe the type of things that are in the tissue. So when you probe exactly the frequency at which you get this flip with some external field and radiation, you are getting a measure of this exact field in this material, and that can give you clues as to the exact structure around it. So you can use this as a mechanism to analyze the structure of the chemicals in the site that you're interested in. So it's a very powerful thing. You can get these spin flips that will happen differently in tissues that are different. So you can use this as a mechanism to get some pictures of things inside a body. So it's a very, very important thing overall. But it requires a good magnetic field, all right, and one that you have to know that's very uniform and that you can basically ramp up and down, typically. For really strong field, things like CAT scans, I think they use superconducting magnets. So there you just do the current loop thing. But in many instances, what you have are really good and finely machined iron poles, which basically will shape the field. You have to be careful about exactly what alloy of iron you use and everything so that you know what your field is very, very precisely. When you've done that, you then have to know what that field is for what your current is and how to make that field something that you know. And so let's look at this because it really is important in the real world. What I'd like to do is to plot what we see for the external field and look at the field that we have in the iron, which also is a measure of the field that the iron produces outside of it. So let us start at zero. I mean, let us assume that this iron, through some magic, has all of its domains sort of in random directions, okay? And there is a way of doing that. Basically, you can I better not shut up. I'm going to say something wrong with that. You can basically produce it that way. So if we have this idealized iron, when we have external field and the internal field is zero because the domains are all in the same spot, you're going to start about right here. Now, as you increase the field external to the iron, you will begin to align the domains, and they will enhance the field. So what happens is, as you begin to enhance the field, this thing is going to crawl up. So you're going to have a stronger field in the iron than the external field, which you have here. It's going to grow faster in the iron than you are growing the external field. So this is where you get this. You get field strength for free, basically, by putting it in an external field, and you get an addition to the strength of it. And this will keep happening up until you have all of the domains aligned, which is what we call saturation. And that typically happens, and this is a good number to have just on top of your head, is around 2 Tesla. It's really important. That means that in the laboratory, if you're creating creating fields and everything, it's not so hard to create 2 Tesla fields in the lab that are really well known and understood. It takes a chunk of iron shaped right and current loop. And you know, you can crank the current up to where you can get up to about a 2 Tesla, less than a 2 Tesla field, but you'll get a 2 Tesla field in the iron, and at that point most of these domains are actually aligned, okay? to go stronger, you're no longer getting a kick from the iron. They're already giving you all they can get. So the only thing you can do is crank more and more current. And that's a power bill. Okay, so that gets to be expensive. It's linear, right? As you crank more and more current, you do get the stronger field, but now you're paying the price for the power bill at a deep level. All right, so that actually in many instances is prohibitive. It also can produce a lot of heat. So you've got cooling issues and everything. So that becomes complicated. So that's about the biggest the field can be, right, typically, without just at all coming from your current loop. So now what you want to do is to crank the current down. And let's look, so crank the external field down, and let's see what happens to the internal field when we do that. So we're moving up this curve like this, and now as we turn down the field externally, it doesn't follow the same path down. And in fact, even when we turn this external field all the way down to zero, domains begin to go out of alignment, but you still have a lot of them aligned, so we have a very much non-zero field inside the material. As we now go negative in the external field, so we've flipped the sign relative to what we had initially, we still have a positive field going up in the iron, but the domains are all beginning to flip. So as we go more and more negative, we get this thing going to zero very quickly, and then as we go even more negative, we begin to align the things up the other way. And then if we turn the field back the other way, we sort of get this kind of loop. And this is known as a hysteresis loop. And it is reproducible. Okay? So if you really want to know what the magnetic field is in your instrument, you literally have to take it all the way around the hysteresis loop and back to the point where you know what the field strength really is. So there's a bit of current cycling and everything you have to do to really understand what the field is if you have a changeable magnetic field that involves iron. Yes? It does, and I guess I probably drew these wrong. It will now change proportionally. Yeah, so I probably drew these a little bit. What I'm trying to do is to get it to look asymptotic to a line that's now proportional. So something, this comes up and does something more like that. So you want to sort of be asymptotic to that line at that point, I think, yeah. Because basically what happens is when you reach that point, now all you're doing is adding field strength from the additional current, which should be proportional to the current. Any questions on this? Okay. So what I'd like to do now is to sort of step back. We've basically covered electricity, we've covered magnetism. And what I want to do now is to just sort of step back and look at all the pieces that we've got so far. So let's see. We have Gauss's law. And Gauss, remember, is the integral over the surface of E dot dA, so we're looking at the flux through a surface, is equal to Q enclosed over epsilon naught. And this is also really happens because we have such a thing as an electric monopole, an electric charge. Okay, in magnetism, if you go out and look, there is no such thing, right? There actually was a recent paper that someone called my attention to that showed up in Nature about a week and a half ago of something called a magnetic monopole, which can be induced in a solid-state system, which is a little bit weird. But in terms of fundamental particles that are out there, there is no such thing as a magnetic charge. Okay, there's only a magnetic dipole, like a little bar magnet or a current loop where the field lines go around. Remember, electric charge, for a single charge, a positive charge, the field lines, it's a source of field, right? There's no magnetic source for field that we know of just in nature. It doesn't necessarily have to be that way, and maybe one of you will get a Nobel Prize finding magnetic, fundamental magnetic monopoles. Okay, this is one of the weird things that we have here. So we're going to write this equation, which is basically Gauss's law for magnetism, but it's equal to zero. And the reason it's equal to zero is because we have no magnetic monopoles. Just as an aside, there are cosmological theories and particle theories which basically say we should have monopoles, and we don't actually know why we don't have them out in the real world. And in fact, at the start of the Big Bang, in principle, there were supposed to be lots of them formed, and if you calculate, there should actually be a lot, and people go look, they don't find it. So that's an actual real problem. And there's a guy named Alan Guth in the 1980s came up with a completely wacky idea that at the start of the Big Bang, you have this very high energy density and everything, and you do have a lot of magnetic monopoles, and then this bit of space does this massive hyper-expansion really fast. And we call this whole thing inflation, and there are ways to make it happen. But what happens is the magnetic monopole density drops to zero because of this inflation of the space, which then, as inflation stops, the energy that's driving the inflation gets dropped into the radiation and particles that we have at the start of the Big Bang. So this is a real weird piece of cosmology in there, but I probably shouldn't have said anything about that right now. Sorry. I've been reading all about this crap this year. Anyway, it's very cool. In principle, that could be that there are such things as magnetic monopoles that were actually formed in nature that we don't see because there are so few of them left after this inflationary period. Anyway, classically, you don't hear about any of this stuff, okay? It's just you go look, there is no such thing as a magnetic monopole, and that is the equation that quantifies that. Don't drag me off any further into this. We'll talk after class. Let me finish this, or at least get this going so we're set up for next class. So then we also have Ampere's law. So if you remember, Ampere's law says that we have the integral around the closed curve of B dot dl is equal to mu zero times I enclosed, which I'm going to rewrite as mu zero times the integral of J dot dA. So this would be the current density dotted into the area. This is just current, right? Okay. And then we've seen Faraday. Faraday says that the integral of E dot dl going around a loop is minus the change with respect to time of the magnetic flux. Okay? So this basically is everything we've done up to this point in terms of the fundamental physics. And if you look at this, there's actually some symmetry between B and E, but it's by no means perfect symmetry. If there were things like magnetic monopoles, then we would have something here which would be basically the magnetic monopole charge divided by, I don't know, we'd have some mu in here probably. And then we also have some asymmetry here. I mean, these are symmetric in B and E, but this side really isn't. So I want to think about this just a little bit. Let's look at Ampere's law. This says that if I draw a loop, right, and I have a current that goes through it, then I get this. Then I have a magnetic field around that loop, basically, and that's how we use it. So let's look at that. Here we've got a loop. And now I take a current that goes through that loop, like so. And Ampere's law is just fine. But now the thing is, this current has to go through a surface which is subtended by this curve, basically, or that's surrounded by this curve. And in the mathematics that does this, that surface does not have to be in the same plane as the curve. So what happens if, for example, we have a capacitive plate here and another capacitor here? You still have current going through here, right? If you're charging a capacitor, you do get current going through the other side. And you can draw the surface to look something crazy like this. So you think of a chef's hat, and you take the chef's hat and you slide it onto that side of the capacitor, and now you have no current that actually passes through the surface that this curve subtends if you think of this as that surface. So there's like a loophole in Ampere's law that makes it not quite work under this particular circumstance. So James Clerk Maxwell looks at this and he tried to fix it. And the way he fixed it was he thought, well, that may be true that you don't have a current passing through there, but you do have, if you have a current here, you do have an electric field in this region that is changing in time. So he added a term to this equation. He modified Ampere's law by adding a term that looks like this. So he allows for the time dependent of this electric flux to contribute here. Okay? And this is known as Maxwell's displacement term. And with that, we have these equations complete, and they are symmetric. In a world where you have no currents, for example, this goes away, and these equations are now completely symmetric, except that we have no magnetic monopole. And this set of equations, they're known as Maxwell's equations. And this is the integral form of them. All right? And we're going to talk a whole lot about them over the next couple of weeks. So I'm out of time. Physics 113 wants to come in, so we'll have to stop there. See you Thursday.